this is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Stephen Levitsky is a professor of government and director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard University, and he is with us today. Welcome, Professor Levitsky.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, how many years have you been studying systems of government around the world?
I've been studying democracies and authoritarianism for a little over 30 years.
30 years. Okay. So let's say 2015 or even 10 years ago, if someone had told you that perhaps the most urgent area of study would be the United States itself and that American democracy is in retreat, what would you have said?
15 or 20 years ago, I would have laughed them out of the room. I think almost all of us a couple of decades ago took the stability of U.S. democracy for granted. A decade ago would have made a little more sense. I started to worry during the Obama administration about the level of polarization and the beginnings of the erosion of norms that really accelerated in the last 5 years. So a decade ago, I might not have laughed you out of the room. 20 years ago, for sure.
Mm. And now, how would you describe the state of U.S. democracy today?
I think it is extraordinarily vulnerable and fragile. I think there is a significant chance, certainly not a certainty, not a certainty, but a significant chance that we could face a serious crisis and even a breakdown around the 2024 election.
What does that mean? What does a breakdown, a potential breakdown mean?
What it means is the election could be stolen, that the either overturn the outcome of the vote or even the outcome in the Electoral College could be overturned. And so the person who assumes office in January 2025 might not be the person who was elected president. And that would be an authoritarian outcome.
Does the U.S. even have a functioning democracy right now if that is indeed if you're saying that that's a possibility for a mere handful of years from today?
Look, our institutions have become, in many senses, pretty dysfunctional. Given the level of polarization, it's extremely difficult to respond to crises, to pass legislation, to carry out much-needed reforms, even urgent reforms. We still have a democracy. After all the concerns and crises of the 2020 election, Joe Biden was freely and fairly elected and assumed office. We're not systematically violating basic civil rights. So our democracy is much more fragile than it was 25 years ago, but it's intact.
Well, Professor Levitsky is one of more than 100 scholars who recently published a statement of concern, but it reads more like a high decibel alarm about U.S. democracy. I mean, they are saying in their statement, quote, that America's entire democracy is now at risk and that initiatives are transforming several states into political systems that no longer meet the minimum conditions for free and fair elections. So today, we're going to be talking about why these scholars are saying that, their responses to, say, lawmakers who say changes in voting laws are actually making U.S. democracy stronger, and what, if anything, can be done. So Stephen Levitsky is one of the scholars we'll be talking to, and joining us now is another, Susan Stokes, professor of political science and director of the Chicago Center on Democracy at the University of Chicago. Professor Stokes, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, is also with us today. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
So, Professor Stokes, I'm wondering if, following on from what Professor Levitsky was saying, in a sentence or two, how would you describe right now the state of American democracy?
Very much at risk. I agree with Professor Levitsky that we are technically a democracy. We had national elections. An incumbent lost the election and was replaced by the winner from the opposition party. That's a very, very minimalist definition of democracy, and we still fit. We had institutions that held in that stressed election. We had election administrators at the state level. We had judges. We had voters. And we sort of squeaked through, but it's a very dynamic, very fluid situation, and there are reasons to be worried that some of those sort of protectors of democracy, some of the institutions and actors who held this last time may be much debilitated next time around.
Jack Beatty, I have to say it's quite something to hear a scholar of democracy, I mean, Professor Stokes runs the Center on Democracy at the University of Chicago, saying that the U.S. still fits the minimalist definition of democracy. Your thoughts on that?
What a comfort that is. You know, this business of elections and decisive elections, in his really incomparable pamphlet on tyranny, Tim Schneider, the Yale historian, he's been a guest on our program, he writes this about elections. He said, the hero of a David Lodge novel says that you don't know when you make love for the last time, that you are making love for the last time. So it is with voting. Germans in 1932 didn't know they were voting for the last time. Czechs in 1946 didn't know they were voting for the last time. Russians in 1990 in their last free election, they didn't know it was their last. And to hear these scholars talk, is 2024 our 1932? Is it our 1946, our 1990? The point is, it's happened elsewhere. And Sinclair Lewis, to the contrary, it can happen here.
Professor Levitsky, your response to that?
Well, I see it a little bit differently. I don't think that the risk is 1932 Germany. I don't think the risk is that elections will disappear and will collapse into outright dictatorship or autocracy. And I think it may be somewhat problematic to be looking for that, because the outcome I think is going to be more subtle. I think we're going to continue to have elections, but we may have unfair elections. We may sort of careen out of democracy and into minority rule for a few elections. I think the possibility or the risk of outright dictatorship, anything like the regimes in Europe in the 1930s, remains quite low. But that should not blind us to the fact that we could slide into something that's considerably less than democratic. We could slide into minority rule for a decade or more.
And Professor Stokes, your thoughts?
I agree that we are unlikely to stop having elections. What the danger is that we will have elections that half the country will think were unfair if their side didn't win, and will be incensed by irresponsible political leaders into action, including possibly armed action. So It's not the case that we are going to stop. It's not like we're in danger of being the lover who is unbeknownst to him or herself making love for the last time. It's more that we are seeing a kind of fraying of the quality of our elections, and following that, a fraying of our belief in the quality of them collectively, and that's just as dangerous.
Jack, did you want to respond to that?
Well, of course, one doesn't imagine a dictatorship here. But is there a qualitative difference between a sham election or an election which is just a kind of ritual and an election that can actually determine a peaceful transfer of power? We had something unprecedented happen. You know, the incumbent wouldn't concede. He still doesn't concede. And that big lie about his being, you know, he was defrauded, there was mass, all that, that's out there. That's still poisoning the water. And Judge Amy Jackson Barrett recently said, you know, it caused violence once, it can cause it again. And so, yes, there'll be elections, but in under what circumstances, with an overhang of the threat of violence hanging over everything.
Yeah. Professor Stokes, let me turn back to you on something, because you said a minute ago that we face the prospect of having elections in the future where a vast swath of the country doesn't believe in its in their outcomes. But aren't we already there? I mean, I feel like we are already there, because recent polls over the past couple of months show that, for example, a Reuters poll from April finds that 60% of Republicans continue to believe Donald Trump's claim that Joe Biden's win was due to voter fraud, despite, of course, any evidence of the such. So we're already in a place where a huge number of Americans do not have confidence or do not have a belief in the integrity or outcomes of an election.
And where we're about to go, or where we're in danger of going, is the other half not believing that we had free and fair elections. So, you know, that's this strange and frightening dynamic we're in, where we had one, you know, big lie taking hold in the electorate in the Republican side. So that, as you say, many, you know, majority of Republican voters believe that there was widespread fraud and that the elections were stolen. And that's leading then to a kind of opportunistic move on the part of Republican legislatures to, you know, make it harder to vote and enable themselves to step in and reverse the outcome of elections. And when that happens, then the other half of the electorate is going to not believe in the freedom and fairness of elections. Now, those beliefs are going to be grounded much more in reality than the beliefs on the Republican side grounded in the big lie. But that doesn't matter. I mean, when we get to a point where everyone is doubting the freedom and fairness of the elections, we are in a very dangerous place. Right.
Well, Susan Stokes, Jack Beattie, and Stephen Levitsky, stand by here for just a second. We will have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with several scholars of history and democracy about a letter or statement of concern they recently signed. More than 100 scholars signed this statement of concern, sounding the alarm about the United States democracy, saying it is now at risk. And in this statement of concern, they say, quote, when democracy breaks down, it typically takes many years, often decades, to reverse that downward spiral. In the process, violence and corruption typically flourish and talent and wealth flee to more stable countries, undermining national prosperity. It is not just our venerated institutions and norms that are at risk. It is our future national standing, strength, and ability to compete globally. We're going to talk with them about why they're saying this about democracy in the United States now. And I'm joined today by Susan Stokes, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Stephen Levitsky joins us as well. He's a professor of government at Harvard University. Our On Point news analyst, Jack Beattie, is with us as well. And if you could all just listen along here for a second, I want to get the voices of some of our listeners in here. For example, here's Bella DeLacio, a rising senior at George Mason University, and she echoes your concerns about the future of U.S. democracy.
We're seeing a lot of different voter suppression bills all over, especially in Georgia, because in Georgia, you know, they flipped the election, they turned blue, and it's because we had a lot of Black, Indigenous, and people of color voting in the state. And now, you know, there's more representation. And immediately after, you know, Republican legislatures have put that under attack. So I'm actually very scared.
That's Bella DeLacio, rising senior at George Mason University. And here's Michael Logue, a trustee for Union Township in Ohio. And after he read the statement of concern from these scholars, here's what his response was.
When I read the list of signatories on the letter, it's nothing but a parade of professors from liberal academic institutions. Their concern is nothing more than a partisan reaction to common sense voter integrity legislation being advanced in places like Georgia. The Georgia law allows for no excuse required absentee voting, while Delaware, President Biden's home state, does not. Red states across the nation, like Georgia, Iowa, and my home state of Ohio, have free and fair elections and are taking steps to keep it that way.
It's Michael Logue from Union Township in Ohio. Stephen Levitsky, you're going to hear this over and over again because, again, we talked about how it's not just a small slice of America we're discussing here. If we're speaking about Republican voters, there are more than 74 million of them voted for Donald Trump. I mean, how would you respond to Michael Logue, who just sees the letter and the concerns as nothing but more hyper-partisanship?
Well, that's very easy to say. But I think the core problem with Mr. Loeb's statement is this statement that these are common sense measures to protect voter integrity. There is no evidence, and there has been no evidence over years, of any large-scale or systematic fraud in elections in the United States. There's no evidence for it. So these are cures without a disease, which suggests that there are some other ends that Republicans are seeking in carrying out these voter measures. There's just no empirical evidence to suggest that measures need to be taken to make it harder to register and exercise suffrage.
Mm. Well, Professor Stokes, what I wonder is that, I mean, obviously, Stephen Levitsky is completely correct about the fact there's no evidence for any kind of widespread voter fraud in American elections. But as we discussed, there's ample evidence for a lack of trust in the system already. Now, where that lack of trust has come from ought to be named, right? It's through lies from legislators. It's through the amplification of those lies in social media and, you know, cable TV. It's through our very sort of toxic information ecosystem that we have here in the United States right now. But I wonder if it is possible to look at these pieces of legislation, these voting legislation, voting bills that are being passed in several states as an attempt, perhaps misguided, but as an attempt to solve that problem, that illness, the illness of the lack of trust, that in fact it would help create more trust in the voting system.
You know, you could make the argument that that some of those measures could increase trust among Republican voters, among voters who have taken in the big lie. But I think the giveaway are the parts of many measures where the state legislature can just step in and reverse the outcome of the election, can certify in a direction opposite of the one that the election administration officials have decided. So that you know, that's kind of an indication that it's not really tightening the rules in ways that will make elections more free and more fair, but giving a kind of escape route when the GOP legislators don't like the outcome. You know, look, we have a fair amount of experience. So the Supreme Court, in Shelby County versus Holder in 2013, took away the protections in the 1965 Voting Rights Act, where that kind of regulated election procedures from southern states. That was rescinded in 2013. And since then, we've had a lot of measures at the state level that have tightened restrictions, requirements for voters. And I think what we've seen, and this is backed up by political science research, is that there's sort of a counter-mobilizing effect that those measures, those strict voter ID laws and the like have had. So they didn't end up having a net effect of successfully suppressing African American votes and votes of young people and of lower income people, and so that those measures turned out not to be enough to change the outcome and to stop states like Georgia from becoming going from red to purple to possibly blue and Arizona and the like. So there's it's naive. It's sort of self-serving to say that these are not aimed at changing the outcomes of elections.
Mm. Well, Jack, we're getting a lot of response here from listeners. One listener tells us, only since Reconstruction has there been such a concerted effort to deny the results of a fair election. Democrats and Republicans theoretically could work it out by making legislation that focuses both on voting rights and election integrity, but there isn't enough common ground. And then we have this from a listener on Facebook who says, we have been through two world wars, the Civil War, along with financial meltdowns, yet we are alive and thriving. These scholars can't see the forest for the trees. What do you think about that, Jack?
I'm struck with a comment of Sean Wilentz, who's an American historian. Mm-hmm. And he said there's no precedent in American history for Donald Trump and Trumpism. None. So I don't take comfort from the past, the American past. Yes, we've been through trials, but this is I don't know enough about the period, but it strikes me this is much more like the 1850s, where you had the lead in to some big breakup, some smash of the system, and there you had a concerted effort on the part of the Southern democracy, the Democratic Party, to install minority rule in every way, on the Supreme Court, presidential appointments, vetoes, the whole gamut of things that can, and they were trying to hold back the Northern population, the bulge of the, and finally they concluded they couldn't do it, and they, when Lincoln was elected, they seceded. The point is, if you're looking around for comparisons, I don't look to the World Wars and say, well, we survived that. I look to the 1850s and I said, well, we didn't survive that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jack, Susan, and Stephen, hang on here because I'd like to bring in another signatory to this statement of concern. Anna Gudmalabusa joins us. She's professor of international studies and director of the Europe Center at Stanford University. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
I'm wondering what it is about, from your study, your scholarship, your experience, that led you to believe it was important to sign this statement of concern.
I think there are two things. One is, as both Steve and Sue have earlier suggested, we are living in an era of the big lie, where voters are being suppressed for no good reason at all. And that's extremely worrisome on its own account. I did a sort of quick back of the envelope calculation, and the Conservative Heritage Foundation has only documented 1,300 or 1,300 cases of documented fraud over the last 20 years of elections. Meanwhile, we've had something like 986 million votes cast in one federal election after another. So that means that all these laws are addressing something that is a problem for 0.00013% of the vote. And that's kind of an outrageous response that, as Sue and Steve has suggested, probably has other motives. I think the second reason I'm worrying is because as a scholar of Europe, I see what's happened in places like Poland, Hungary, and Turkey, and I worry that that's going to be the future of the United States, sort of modern authoritarianism. But if you squint hard enough, it looks like a democracy. But in fact, the democracy is sort of deeply eroded and very fragile.
So can you just give us a little bit more analysis on that? How about Hungary in particular? Like you said, if you squint hard enough, it looks like a democracy, but it's not really. And why specifically in Hungary?
So if you squint, you know, these countries still have elections. People still travel and they gather freely. The government is genuinely popular among a significant minority. But the minority rules like a majority, and it's basically subverted democracy by attacking courts and oversight institutions, by denouncing the opposition as illegitimate, by attacking the media as fake, and in fact, in many cases, sort of making sure that only sort of state propaganda outlets can survive. And finally, in the Hungarian case, by deliberately skewing the election laws in ways that permanently favor the current governing party. They basically rewrote the Constitution, which is an unlikely outcome in the United States. But the skewing of the election laws certainly looks very familiar.
So short of rewriting the Constitution, I'm having a hard time hearing how this is meaningfully different from what is happening right now in the United States.
It's not. And that's why I'm worried.
Well, Stephen Levitsky, your area of expertise in particular as head of the Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard is Latin America. Are there moments in history or particular nations that you would point to as also illustrative of the path the U.S. might go down?
Sure. I mean, I think the European cases that Anna mentioned are probably the best parallels, because if U.S. democracy is to die, it's likely to die a gradual, subtle civilian death by electoral means via civilian authorities. It's unlikely that we'll see the kind of military coup d'etat that has killed democracies in most of Latin America. Very briefly, just one important difference between Hungary and the United States today is that one reason why Orban and Fidesz was able to consolidate power so quickly was a very weak opposition. And one positive, one thing the U.S. has going for it is a pretty evenly matched distribution of power. The Democratic Party and Democrats, small d, in general, are pretty well organized, electorally viable, well financed, and quite able to compete. And so that's a big difference from Hungary, and a big difference from the cases in Latin America, like Venezuela. The case that I point to is the best parallel to the United States in Latin America, sadly, is Chile in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. That is a case where a very strong democratic tradition, strong democratic institutions, a democratic breakdown was almost unthinkable if you go back to the 1960s. But politics grew so polarized, and each side grew so came to view the other side as such an existential threat that they were willing to employ any means necessary, including a brutal and bloody military coup, to prevent the other side from being in power. The difference in the United States is, I think, the polarization is asymmetric. Only one side has really sort of gone to a point of extremism that's beginning to threaten our institutions.
Professor Levitsky, I know I've got to let you go here in a couple of minutes, so let me just stick with you for another moment here. So do you place some hope in the asymmetric polarization here versus the sort of, it sounds like you're describing a more uniformly hyper-polarized situation in 1970s Chile?
Yeah, I don't know if that doesn't necessarily, the fact that the Democrats and that, I should expand that, the small d Democratic coalition includes not big enough, but a significant number of conservatives as well. The strength of that coalition gives me some hope. But the asymmetry, not so much. I think that a democracy cannot survive for very long in a two-party system where one party is not willing to play by democratic rules of the game. So the situation that we're in now, right now, is really not sustainable until one way or another, till the Republican Party leadership recommits to playing by democratic rules of the game, our democracy will be threatened, asymmetry or not.
Jack, we've got about a minute here to go before the break. How would you respond to Stephen Levitsky saying that what's required here is Republican Party leadership recommitting to small d democracy in this country?
It's hard to see the dynamics currently at play that would bring that about, other than total defeat, you know, something like a Goldwater-like defeat. But, of course, the Goldwater election, that didn't sound the knell to right-wing extremism in a way. It just sort of went underground and became a little more suburban and went and Ronald Reagan. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to see anything short of defeat that would take this out of that would cause elites, Republican elites, to change ground. They're terrified of their own voters. They've created their voters with these lies, and now they're reaping the whirlwind. They're just look at someone like Liz Cheney. Look at the she's warned recently that members of her caucus told her, yeah, we would vote to impeach Trump, but we're afraid for our personal safety. And we read that threats to Congress people have gone up 100% in the last year. Those are some of them, the base that the Republican elites are afraid of.
Well, Aaron Palicki on Facebook says the dangers that our country will become like Russia, where they call opposition parties terrorists and have pro forma elections where the people who are in charge always win. If we have elections like that, a lot of people won't even notice much changing. Stephen Levitsky, with that, I've got to let you go. He's a professor of government at Harvard University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Susan Stokes and Anna Gujmala Busa and Jack Beattie, stand by. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking with several scholars who are amongst more than 100 scholars who recently signed what's sort of placidly called a statement of concern, but really it's a very strongly worded alarm about the future of American democracy. They are saying that the United States democracy is at risk. And I'm joined today by Susan Stokes. She's professor of political science and director of the Chicago Center on Democracy at the University of Chicago. Also co-director of Brightline Watch, an initiative to monitor democratic practices in the United States. Anna Gujmala Busa joins us as well. She is a professor of international studies and director of the Europe Center at Stanford University. And Jack Beattie joins us as well. He is On Point's news analyst. And Professor Gujmala Busa, I wonder if you could respond to the comment that I had just read a little earlier from one of our listeners who says that we could have continued erosion in the faith of the electoral process. We could have the emergence of perpetual minority rule here, but that a lot of people wouldn't even notice much changing. I mean, she drew Russia as an example. What do you think about that?
Well, I think people did know what was changing in Russia, as every place else. I agree with Steve Levitsky that we're not heading towards some kind of a totalitarian scenario. This is not going to be, Nazi Germany or communist Russia, Soviet Union. But I do think that real danger is that we're basically like the proverbial frog being slowly boiled alive. And so democracy is being chipped away in the United States in various ways, small and big. And we're not noticing what this all adds up to until it's too late. I think when you look at what happened in Europe, in Poland or in Hungary, these were relatively quick motions to basically attack these institutions and attack opposition and attack the media. But most people didn't see it as a full-fledged attack on democracy until it was too late.
But if I may, I've heard all of you now, actually, save for Jack, say that this is not going to end up going the way of Germany post-1930s. But I would have said, I will say to you that 5 months ago, 6 months ago, I don't think I would have ever said that a mob of insurrectionists who were armed and actually wanted to bring even more weapons into the Capitol would attack the United States Capitol building in an attempt to stop an ongoing count of the Electoral College, who had maps of the Capitol building, who were organized to try to their desire was to corral lawmakers into corridors where they could lock them in and do God knows what. I don't think I would have ever imagined that happening in the United States, and yet it did. So are we still feeling a little too confident in the fundamental strength of American democracy to not head down the road that Jack was talking about earlier in the show?
Well, I would say two things to that. I think one is we've seen episodes of terrorist violence in the United States already with the civil rights movement around the turn of the century, with the labor movement, and in the run-up to the Civil War. So this sort of episodic vicious violence is not something that democracies don't contend with. Mm. But I think more importantly, you know, these days, authoritarians aren't totalitarians. The modern authoritarian still holds elections. People are still allowed to travel. There's an aura of sort of normalcy built around it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the United States might be heading, rather than some kind of an ideologically coherent totalitarian system that rests entirely on violence and on sort of direct control of the people.
Mm, I see. Professor Stokes, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I actually don't think the slowly boiling toad is or frog is the right analogy. In part because we are a very organized society, going all the way back to de Tocqueville, the 19th century. We are a society very rich in civic organization and mobilization. During the Trump administration, we saw the two largest popular protest movements in American history: the Women's March in January 2017, and the Racial Justice Marches last summer. Those were the largest marches ever. So I think that frog is jumping out of the pot and he's picking up a banner and waving it around. And so I think a more likely outcome, which in some ways I suppose is better, but also has its own perils, is that we have another set of elections that are problematic or seen as problematic, have outcomes that people don't like, and we have we have a lot of people in the streets protesting, and we're also a highly armed society, and we have just seen a terrible incident of political violence, organized political violence, organized from the very top, but with great resonance among people in our society. But I do want to say that I don't think any of this is inevitable. Mm. I don't think the loss of American democracy slowly is inevitable. I think we have a small and probably rapidly closing window of solving the problem slowly with good public policy that has good outcomes for people that they can see and they can appreciate making a difference in their lives. I think that the Biden administration has, in a sense, the right strategy of solving the economic problem, solving the pandemic problem as quickly as possible, as well as possible, and letting people see that life is actually better, that public policy can have good effects on your life, do things for you that are going to make your life easier and the life of your family easier. And that's not going to win over the hardcore, the folks who, assaulted the Congress, mm-hmm. but it is going to win over moderates, independents. You know, Biden's approval ratings are quite high, and so that's our sort of small and potentially closing window. I have a lot of friends, largely Democrat, capital D Democrat friends, who are who think that the whole problem boils down to winning the next election. I think winning the next sets of elections is important because that window of good public policy stays open. But I don't think it solves the whole problem. I think it's going to take a number of iterations of good public policy making a difference in people's lives.
Okay. So, Jack, let me get your take on that. Can that good public policy be made, though?
Well, there does seem to be. I mean, President Manchin seems not to want it to be made. He's blocking the Voting Reform Act. The politics of remedy is got us out of the problem of the depression. I mean, look at 1936. It looked clear, that Huey Long was a threat. Americans might have gone in the direction of authoritarian government, but the politics of remedy supervened. Of course, FDR had majorities of 100 seats at one point in the Congress. And in the 1934 election, that was one of only three instances in the last who knows how many cycles where the incumbent party won in the off-year election. Almost everybody thinks the Democrats are going to lose in 2022. So remedy, yes, but that window is so, so small and so precarious. And as I say, what President Manchin wants, he pretty much is going to get.
Well, you know, I want to move towards talking more specifically about, you know, solutions, what can be done. But in order to do that, first of all, let's just remind ourselves sort of where the Republican Party in particular is on the question of democracy in the United States right now. Because you will recall, all of you will recall that last month, Representative Liz Cheney was voted out of her party leadership position by fellow Republicans for her insistence on naming former President Donald Trump's lies about the 2020 election and standing up to those lies. And here's what Cheney said before being defenestrated by her party.
Remaining silent and ignoring the lie emboldens the liar. I will not participate in that. I will not sit back and watch in silence while others lead our party down a path that abandons the rule of law and joins the former president's crusade to undermine our democracy.
Now, the scholars who have written this statement of concern focus mightily on the strengthening elections, expanding the right to vote, and there are bills, of course, pending in Congress, democratically sponsored bills that are designed to do just that. They're meeting resistance, though. Here's Senator Mitch McConnell just yesterday when asked if he'd be willing to support the John Lewis Voting Rights Act.
The Supreme Court did not strike down the Voting Rights Act. It's still the law. What they struck down was the pre-clearance part of it. It applied only to the southern part of the United States because the Supreme Court concluded the conditions that existed in 1965 no longer existed. So there's no threat to the voting rights law. It's against the law to discriminate in voting on the basis of race already. And so I think it's unnecessary.
Anna Gujmala-Busa, let me ask you this. McConnell is particularly salient here because what I wonder is that really, unlike other democracies, this is, in the United States, we have a two-party system. And if one of those parties, as evidenced by leaders such as Mitch McConnell, first of all, does not believe that voting needs to be further protected or expanded, and in fact also is very deliberately prioritizing a kind of power politics to solidify Republican, you know, his power in particular, and not necessarily do the things that Susan Stokes was talking about earlier about creating good public policy. I mean, how can any solutions be found through legislation to help and protect the democracy?
You know, I think the first thing that we might want to talk about is trying to end the filibuster. And if you look at comparatively, this, you know, supermajority requirements exist in some 40 other countries. And supermajorities basically mean that you have to not just get 50% plus one to pass legislation, but, you know, 60%, 65%, 66%. But those are for major constitutional changes, not for normal bills and not for a normal legislature. And so the United States is unique in institutionally allowing a minority to hold the majority hostage when it comes to legislature in the Senate. And I think that's one of the first places we ought to talk about. And this is not, you know, enshrined in the Constitution. This is in no way a statute. It's simply a tradition that emerged, in fact, out of trying to prevent the extension of civil rights to African Americans. So I think we should talk more seriously about the filibuster and how weird it is that that one of the oldest democracies in the world allows a minority to hold the majority hostage.
Well, Susan Stokes, we just have a few minutes left here, and I always think about this is all landing with individual listeners. And so to that point, I want to just play another little moment from Bella Delasio. You heard her a few minutes ago. She's that rising senior at George Mason University, and she asked about what Congress, but what she can do to help protect American democracy.
My question would be, what is the most immediate step that people who aren't elected officials can do to ensure that we have a safe and protected democracy in the future, an equitable democracy? What is our immediate step?
Professor Stokes, how would you answer that?
I am so overjoyed when I hear college students like Bella, really concerned about public policy, about public affairs, and really concerned about the state of our democracy. I completely share her sense of urgency and sense of urgency that others have expressed on the show. It is a drop everything moment, and do what you can. I try to keep my focus by thinking about, James Madison, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King, are the people who helped forge this country and try to make it a better country, and are looking down on us at this moment and wondering, what are we going to do to keep it going? Somebody mentioned Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny. There are a number of really great, very specific suggestions in that lovely book. I think many people have already read it. Reread it, especially as we get into the next election cycle, the 2022 midterms. Figure out what you're good at and do what you can. Make donations. It is, the elections aren't going to solve the problem. If there's a sort of Democratic sweep, if somehow the Democrats do very well in the elections, I think it does buy us time for more public policy, for more good public policy. So, make donations, organize. I think Frederick Douglass put it, agitate, agitate, agitate. Write op-eds, teach your hearts out to your students. Talk to people whom you don't agree with. Mm. Of course, we're so siloed in this country, that's a hard thing to do. I guess the other thing I would say to people like Bella is try to avoid the kind of cynicism and defeatism that's tempting at a moment like this. I talk to my friends about avoiding what I call progressive perfectionism, which is, our institutions aren't perfect, so what's the point of fighting for them? That's not the right idea right now.
Yeah. Jack Beatty, we've got 30 seconds left, but I'm going to give you the last word here.
Well, are we headed for a squint democracy, or as the reporter says, the report says, democracy with asterisks? We don't know, but it's worth fighting for, that's for sure. And I join with the professor in being so heartened to hear that student. And let's hope we can have a public sphere that's worthy of her zeal.
Yeah, well, the squint democracy, that's also stayed in my mind, Jack. And I look back at this letter here, and Professor Stokes mentioned the great names of American history, and that it's those very names and those very efforts that they say could be currently being betrayed. Our precious democratic heritage in this country risks betrayal. Let's not let that happen. So Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so much for being with us as always.
Thank you.
And Susan Stokes, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Chicago Center on Democracy at the University of Chicago. Professor Stokes, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Anna Gujmala-Busa, Professor of International Studies and Director of the Europe Center at Stanford University. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And we have a link, by the way, to the letter signed by more than 100 scholars of political science and history. That link is at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.